When I started work in September 1935 as a lab assistant, the lab staff consisted of a foreman, W.C. Blanchard, Alex Baines, George Smith, Percy Smith, Ted Hitch, R.H. McClintock, Freddie Dell, Titch Freeman and Jimmy Smith, Les Grindrod and myself. Walter Blanchard retired in 1942 at 65, so was probably there as a boy in the 1890s. Alex Baines told me he was a lab boy when Sir Robert Robertson was chemist research, and both George and Percy Smith started as boys in 1910. R.H. McClintock had just got his ARRC by attending Regent Street Poly in the evenings, but took his BSc the following year and got a first. He left and joined ECP near Harwich, but returned to the ROS during the war and later, in the 1950s, I believe, was awarded the George Cross for his actions after an explosion in the NG section at ROF Bishopton, where he was a chemist in charge. Later, he became ADOFX and finally he was the first director of ROF Burfield, which made nuclear warheads. Unfortunately, he died when only about 50 whilst playing badminton, I believe. Evidently, it had been a practice to appoint principal foreman on production from the lab staff. Reg Blanchard, Walter's brother, was foreman of Cordite. Bert Suckling was foreman gun cotton. Alex Chaplin was foreman stores, and all had previously worked in the lab. It's worth noting that Bert Suckling's father had been killed in the NG explosion at Quinton Hill in 1894. At the end of my first day's work, I was stopped at the main gate by the police and introduced to a small wiry man who said, "Is your name Doe?" When I said yes, he said, "Do you spell it with an E or a W?" When he answered it, he said, "So do I." It transpired that he was a leading fireman and his name was Bill Doe, and that he was a foundling and knew nothing of his antecedents. His son was Stan Doe, who was an electrician's mate, and his granddaughter was G. Jones Smith, who many people will remember as a PA to SPR1 in the 50s. The junior staff in the lab manned the cordite measurement room and the heat test room and quickly became an expert in the use of micrometers and developed good arm muscles, grinding all the cordite samples first thing in the morning for heat test and VM and analysis. The heat test room staff also dried the gun cotton samples brought across from Quinton Hill during the day and carried out the heat tests on NG gun cotton and cordite. Another unpleasant job was to pick about 10-pound samples of cotton waste for woven material. This before the days of Martindale masks, so we tied a length of muslin over our nose and mouth to keep the dust out. The only road on the north side finished at Walton House so that the road vehicles could deliver to the central stores, but bicycles were allowed to be ridden up the long walk to Edmondsey after dismounting to be searched and before crossing the footbridge into the danger area. Everybody, including his superintendent, Dr. Bowden, was subjected to this search before entering the danger area, despite the fact that all contraband was left in cabinets erected in Powdermill Lane outside the main gate. Walton House housed the superintendent's and manager's offices, and the office staff consisting of Charlie Hasler and Mr. French. The one and only messenger uniformed was Bill Bailey, famous for having been a boy soldier with Kitchener at Ondermann. There were no women in the factory at all, and the wages were brought over from RSAF on Friday afternoons in trays, divided into slots about 1.5 inches by 1 inch for each employee. These slots held notes folded to fit and a small pile of loose change. Since the minimum adult wage was about 50 shillings and there were deductions, nobody had a very large pile to collect. On paydays, it was the duty of foremen to read a section of the rule book to all assembled so that nobody could plead ignorance of the rules, even if they couldn't read. Delivery of bulk stores, sodium nitrate, anhydrous sodium carbonate, sulfuric acid in drums, coal, etc., was mainly by barge on the Lee Navigation, and cordite was sent downriver to Woolwich Arsenal by our own sailing barges, which were horse-drawn down to Bow and then hoisted sail for Woolwich. Horses were not allowed inside the factory because they had steel horseshoes, so barges were pulled by a team of men. Empty barges rode too high in times of flood to pass under the refinery bridge, so a pile of lead ingots up to 50 tons was kept by the riverside alongside a wooden hand crane, which was used to load the lead onto an empty barge to enable it to pass under the bridge. The lead was removed on the other side of the bridge by means of a similar hand crane. Explosive barges containing cordite to and from stores and blending and packing houses also passed under the refinery road bridge, and this required a policeman manning the gate to stop the traffic while the boat passed under the road. The stores section had boats used to deliver drums of new materials for storage areas at various places in the plantation. And I remember one character called Admiral Terapet, who was in charge of one of these boats. It was one of our duties to take a sample from each of these drums, and I can recall chipping ice from bungholes before the square-ended key could be inserted to unscrew the bung, and also having glycerin freeze on the sampling pipette, a glass tube about 1 inch diameter and 3 feet long. In hot weather, it was also not unknown for drums to build up pressure, and one could be sprayed with dimethyl aniline, a raw material for petrol, and a rather nasty smelling liquid. A stores labourer who regularly helped on these occasions was Rosa Kiff, who later became a messenger. The only piecework job in the factory was unloading barges of sodium nitrate and soda ash and stacking the 200 weight slacks in stores alongside the river. This was done entirely by hand. Men carried the sacks on their backs from the barge, climbed a short ladder onto the bank, walking along the bank and stacking in the store up to eaves height. Samples were taken, often whilst unloading was taking place, by sticking a steel sampling spear in 10% of the sacks as they were carried by. Early in the war, 1940, shiploads of chili saltpeter were imported and stored in the old refinery buildings and I believe other places in North London. A whole shipload of acetone, some 600 drums, was stored on Lower Island where there was an old sulphur refinery. I set up a lab there and one boy sampled every drum and tested each one for specific gravity and permanganate test on the spot. He picked out one single drum of methyl ethyl ketone among the 600. In 1936, two more staff were recruited, these being Les Cole and Alan Charter. In 1937, George Whitbread and Jim Jeacock, followed by Harry Bird and Ozzie Blay in 1938. All these were from Latimer School in Edmonton, whence Phil Freeman, Grindod and myself had come. Many others had been recruited in 1937 and 38, including some older people such as Bill Roberts, Gary Cooper, Fanny Adams, Eric Speller, Larry Lana, George Sewell. And when war broke out, many more arrived, whose name was Alan, had been an entomologist at the British Museum. He was put to work testing petrol, including a sieving test, which created dust and which was noted for coloration and for causing dermatitis. Lanolin was available in quantity to help combat this. Alan appeared to be resistant to dermatitis, but quickly became highly coloured and quite content to stay in this job for years on end. He was quite a reserved individual and was famous for wearing pyjama trousers and underpants in the winter. In In March 1939, I was sent to the gun cotton lab to join Percy Smith, Bill Roberts having left to join an oil company in Aberdeen. The load leading up to the gate was bordered on the right by acid factories, sulfuric acid concentrators, nitre pots to make nitric acid from sodium nitrate, and denitrating pots for recovery of nitric acid from waste acid. On the left were stores for sodium nitrate and cotton waste. The RDX section was being built on the slopes of Quinton Hill on the left, and a nitric acid concentrating plant capable of producing water white acid 99% plus was built near the gate on the right. The GC foreman at that time was Ernie Monk, who upheld the tradition of wearing his bowler hat as a badge of office, and the chemist in charge was W.H. Simmons. Gun cotton was boiled in alkaline water contained in lead-lined wooden vats no less than 7 times for up to 12 hours at a time, the water being changed between each boil. Water for this process was obtained from our own artesian well, which also supplied the water for washing the gun cotton and for pulping and beating. Unfortunately, never needed to dosing to achieve the required alkalinity. The junior member of the lab staff was confronted each morning with a bench full of samples of the previous day's vat boilings, and soon became proficient at titrating measured portions of these at lightning speed. On 3 shift working, these would number something like 700 samples per week. The lab's main job was to provide the analysis and calculate portions of additions to waste acid to make mixed acid of the correct composition. There were 9 tanks, each 12 feet in diameter and 12 feet high, in the tank farm for mixed acid. These had been there for goodness knows how long and had been little used between the wars. There were holes near the tops of all of them, and one had to remember what height each one could safely be filled. The base for each filling was about 7 feet of strong waste acid direct from the displacement process in the nitration house. An addition was made to this with 20% oleum imported from Spencer Chapman at Silvertown and nitric acid, 88% supposedly made from sodium nitrate, and sulfuric acid from our own factory concentrators. Nitric acid from the DN pots fired by coke fires filled with weak waste acid from nitration was also available for use. Unfortunately, the nitric acid was never as strong as it should have been because the sulfuric acid used was weaker than it should have been due to the poor performance of the ancient Volvic stone concentrators. Although frequent samples were sent to the lab for analysis, I rather fancy that the charge men kept a stock of good samples to send to the lab, and when later during the war a chemist was appointed to keep technical returns, he was completely mystified by the discrepancies he found. Early in the war, we managed to cover by myself staying late till 7 or 8 in the evening, and Percy Smith, who lived near, returning during the night to analyse mixed acids for the next day's production. However, it soon became apparent that we would have to provide nighttime cover, and I began to work a night shift alternating with Jemmy Smith. The factory was working 20 shifts per week, the period from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Sunday being a maintenance period. Since we used one tank, about 200 tons of acid per shift, we were striving to have a reserve of 3 tanks of acid mixed ready for use, since stirring made the acid hot and the refrigeration plant could hardly cope. We were very pleased to have achieved this 1 week. However, we arrived one Sunday morning to find that somebody had opened all the valves on the mixed acid tanks, and the tanks had balanced from one to the other, and with waste acid in others, so we had to work like lightning to get one tank ready for 3 p.m., and this with maintenance staff only on site. Also, to analyse the acid in all the other tanks and get additions of mixing going in at least two others. Somehow, we survived. It was before we started the night shift in the lab and I was leaving at around 7 p.m. that we had a terrible accident at the end plant. A pot had been filled with weak breast acid and the nitric acid had been distilled off. And the sulfuric acid at about 70% and hot was being transported to a storage tank by means of air pressure. When the chargeman noticed fumes coming from a trapdoor high up in the brickwork of the coke furnace, he got up on the staging and opened the steel door, and the silicon iron pot, which must have cracked, split, and he was met with a jet of hot sulfuric acid under pressure. His assistant was immediately below him and was completely covered and soon lying in about 2 tons of hot acid. The chargeman, Peddler Palmer, put his arms up to protect his face and managed to get off the staging. Both men were immersed in the baths of hot water, kept handy for such emergencies, but their clothes were dissolving and the flesh was falling off Peddler's arms. Peddler Palmer survived and was out in the Abbey after the war, wearing gloves over his hands and with a scarred face. The other man, whose own name I cannot recall, died in the Sandhurst for hospital the next day. Soon after the war started, I was appointed gas identification officer for the Quinton Hill area and was provided with an army bicycle, a long Portland coat, a big rattle, some rope, stakes to mark out the affected area. How I was supposed to carry that lot on the bike, I never found out. All I did find out was that if I put the protective coat on, I could not possibly mount the bike. When the war started, a company of pioneer corps was given the task of protecting the factory and patrolled with fixed bayonets. At night time, it was quite unnerving to be challenged by one of these who seemed to lurk in the odd corners and jump out on you. I don't know whether they were more scared than we were, but I know that they were suspected of hiding away for a quiet smoke. Air raids began in earnest in summer 1940, and at first the gates were closed when sirens were sounded. This resulted in the night shift being locked out, and I spent several hours in the ditch waiting for the gate to open when the all clear sounded. Before long, this rule was changed and people had the choice of staying in the shelters or going home through the raid. One night, two men who decided to go home from the cordite section had reached the clocking station near Sewardston Gate when a bomb fell on a non-absorbent paper store on the Chingford side of Quinton Hill. Pieces of concrete from the foundation of the building hit both of these men and killed them. On another occasion, the RDX section on Quinton Hill was sprayed with incendiaries, but fortunately, many which fell on soft ground between buildings did not ignite. Those that did were all extinguished by various means, and the only damage was to the cotton waste store, where bombs penetrated the roof and set fire to the bales of cotton waste, which smouldered rather than flamed, and our own fire brigade, together with the firemen from the town, it contained the fire and eventually extinguished it. In late 1939, there was an explosion in the NG section which did a great deal of damage, resulting in 5 deaths as well as numerous other casualties. One NG Hillman was awarded the George Cross for his bravery. Repairs were carried out and production had only just got underway when there was another explosion in the same area, again causing deaths and injuries. I was not working on the north site at this time and therefore have no personal experiences of these incidents. It was because of these accidents that the new NG Hill site was built, but happily was never needed to be used. In January 1940, Alec Baines, along with Gary Cooper, Fanny Adams and Alan Charter, left to start up the labs at ROF Bishopton, where Factory 1 was just about to start up. I moved back to the Lame Lane Lab later that year and took over the storage inspection section. Despite the fact that all ingredients were inspected by the War Department chemist and later called the chemical inspector at source, we still checked everything that entered the factory, down to the lasting cloth used to make protective clothing. This was tested by igniting about 100 grams of Mark 1 cordite about 6 inches underneath a stretched piece of cloth. The cloth was supposed not to show more than a scorch mark on the upper surface. In the later months of 1940, a Mr. Kendrick joined us at RGPF as a chemist in charge designate for RAF Wrexham, and he was joined by a number of others recruited locally at Wrexham to be trained to staff the labs at the new cordite factory. In January 1941, Phil Freeman left for Wrexham, followed by Jimmy Smith in March and myself in August, by which time Factory 2 was coming into production. It was during this time that parachute mine scored a direct hit on a cordite reel store between the gun powder mills and the factory fence bordering the Waltham Marsh. The main lab lost all of its windows but sustained little other damage. Luckily, all our balances survived intact, despite being on the benches facing windows, which were blown out. The other mine of the pair released at the same time fell in the watercress beds at the Abbey Farm and was responsible for demolishing all the houses surrounding Romeland. The main output from the RGPF in 1935 was MD and W and WM cordite made from gun cotton manufactured at Quinton Hill and nitroglycerin made at Edmondsey. Other products were gun cotton slabs and primers used for demolition. Tetryl, picrite used in this as an essential ingredient in non-flashing cordite. Fuse cake, gunpowder, was exported to RAF Hereford for further processing, and RD202, a fuse powder based on ammonium chlorate and charcoal. Charcoal for both types of fuse powder was made on site from Alder Buckthorn, small stacks of which were kept in the plantation near to the main lab and were favourite places for grass snakes to bask in the sun in summer. The gun cotton for cordite was transported as damp right cylinder shaped mouldings stacked in aluminium boxes by road to the Grand Magazine at Fisher's Green. From there it was taken by boat to the stores where it was dried to about 1% moisture and then to the pouring on house on the NG section at Edmondsey. Here it was weighed out into rubberized bags in the correct proportion of NG added to form a paste. This was moved again by boat to the paste store and from there by hand truck to the narrow gauge mills for the incorporating houses, where other ingredients such as mineral jelly, carbamite and acetone and water mixtures were added in machines similar to baker dough mixers to form a dough. This dough was transported in leather cover boxes to the press houses, where it was extruded in various diameters up to about 1/4 inch in either as solid cord or as tubular cordite cut to length according to the weapon it was intended for. The extruded cord was loaded into boats on wooden trays and taken to the south of the factory adjacent to RSAF, where it was dried in steam heated stoves. From here it went by truck to blending houses, where one box from a number of batches were placed around the floor and operatives walked around, taking equal samples from each box and deposited it in an empty box at the end. This process was repeated with boxes from a number of blends to produce a lot, which was now a fairly homogeneous whole from a large number of incorporator loads. Tetryl, an intermediate explosive used to make gains between detonators and HE fillings, was made by treating dimethyl aniline with nitric acid in the Daisy Island area. It coloured people working there bright yellow, was also a powerful irritant and caused dermatitis to many people. Picrite was made by a fusion process for ammonium nitrate and calcium cyanamide, again in the Daisy Island area, and was used in the manufacture of flashless cordite, which in the late 1930s was in process of development. The gun cotton section also produced 1 pound slabs and 1 ounce primers of gun cotton used for demolition charges. These were pressed from gun cotton straight from the centrifuges and were quite damp. The slabs were placed in tin boxes and the lids soldered in place. The primers were dried in stoves on racks and were then dipped in acetone, which gelatinized the surface. When this had dried, they were threaded onto tape and packed in long tin cylinders holding about 10. In June 1939, the RDX pilot plant built on Quinton Hill came into operation, and the water tower upper story was made into a lab. George Smith had been detached to ARD at Woolwich for a time to learn the necessary tests, and he manned this lab together with Jimmy Smith. In September 1939, when war was declared, it became our only production plant for RDX, and in no time flat we were exporting RDX beeswax and PE1. A sandbag emplacement was made on the old NG Hill site, and we tested the first batches of PE by blowing holes in quarter-inch witness plates with 1-inch diameter right cylinders of PE and electric detonator. We sounded a warning before each shot with a hand-blown Caxon. One of the duties of senior staff at the lab was to take X-ray pictures for the factory doctor, who was a local GP called in when needed. There were two hospitals near to the refinery gate, which were manned by two resident nurses, and anyone injured on site was treated there by the doctor and the two nurses. A not infrequent occurrence was somebody falling from a boat into the river. The treatment for this was to spend the rest of the day in bed in the hospital, presumably while clothes were dried. One extremely important chap who should be mentioned was one Tucker Archer, who was the man who emptied and buried the spoils from the earth closets, and who also was able to cultivate a tremendous crop of tomatoes, all self-sown. Two other important individuals were the water wardens, who wore distinctive khaki whipcord uniforms topped by a deerstalker hat. Their duties were to maintain water levels to enable the water-driven machinery to work and the canals for transport to be kept full and to prevent flooding. They lived in cottages on site. One of these was on Lower Island and the other, Waterways Cottage, on the eastern boundary. Another thing that comes to mind was that every new consignment of glycerin delivered was subjected to a test carried out by Walter Blanchard personally. He took over the large sinks in the main lab for the day while he made a small amount of NG in glass apparatus, washed it, and then subjected it to heat test. I can't remember that this was called for in the specification for glycerin or that it was carried out at ROF Wrexham. Oleum at 15% SO3 and 65% SO3 was imported from Spencer Chapman, since these were the two strengths at which it was liquid. It was emptied through the bunghole on the side of 45-gallon drums, weighing some 800 pounds, into a pressure vessel called an acid egg, sunk into the ground, which was then sealed. The acid was then blown by pipeline to the mixing tanks by means of compressed air. I've heard tales of how a part drum of 65% oleum was accidentally dropped into the river, with the bung being removed, and proceeded downriver in a series of jumps as acid leaked out and boiled the water under the drum. Around 1937, the Propellant Planning Department was set up in No. 9 Powder Mill Lane, which until then had not been used. Mr. Parsons and Mr. Selleck and a team of draftsmen set about planning and design of a replacement factory for RGPF, which was antiquated and, of course, vulnerable to air attack. The result was RAF Bishopton, where the latest technology was used and nitric acid was made from liquid ammonia and sulfuric acid directly by burning sulfur. It seems remarkable that the first section at this factory was able to come into operation in June 1940.